This is the Women's Protection and Empowerment Podcast, where we give space to talking about women and girls in humanitarian settings. At International Rescue Committee, we deliver innovative programs focused on preventing and responding to violence against women and girls. We are in pursuit of a world where women and girls live free from violence as valued and respected members of their community. This movement is about equitable access to opportunities.
Empowering women and girls means a lot for development of the next generation, and it's important for the development of a country.
It's about catalysts for change.
Women and girls are not just the faces of poverty. They're also the key to overcoming.
It's about voice and respect.
The path to victory is still long, and I'm not ready to give up. This has become to me more than a work, but a passion to see women and the girls regaining what has been for long denied to them.
From IRC, this is the WPE Podcast. I'm Christy Crabtree. For a number of years, the IRC has been tracking humanitarian funding to gender-based violence interventions and advocating for humanitarian actors to address GBV from the start of crises. Today, we're going to talk about a report recently released by the IRC called Why Not Local? Gender-Based Violence, Women's Rights Organizations, and the Missed Opportunity of COVID-19. The report, authored by consultant Marcy Hirsch, draws on the perspectives of humanitarian actors across three countries, Cameroon, South Sudan, and Yemen. The report does a stock take of how the pandemic continues to impact women and girls, and it provides a snapshot of funding trends to GBV interventions across the three countries. Importantly, it also asks the question, why not local? Evidencing various barriers that women-led organizations face in accessing funding and being represented in the humanitarian system, and calling for a more equitable distribution of power in the humanitarian system. So today, I'm delighted to have two guests joining to speak about this report. Glory, over to you.
My name is Glory McKenna from ILC, the Women Protection and Empowerment Coordinator for South Sudan Country Program.
Hi, my name is Brianna Guidorzi. I'm Policy Advisor in Women's Protection and Empowerment. I had the pleasure of coordinating the development of this report, working closely with the author, but also many of my other colleagues at the IRC, policy colleagues and also technical colleagues, including Glory.
Can you give us a bit of a background on the report? What was the impetus for this report, and what questions did you want to explore and why?
So for a number of years, the IRC has been kind of chasing up on how the humanitarian system responds to gender-based violence, as you were mentioning in the intro. So this report is very much kind of part of a series and part of that investigation, if we want to call it that. So I'll give a little bit of a background of some of those previous reports that very much led to this one. So a few years ago in 2019, the IRC came out with a report called Where is the Money? And in this report, we evidenced that only 0.12% of global humanitarian funding from the years 2016 to 2018 had gone to addressing GBV. So, you know, that's less than 1%. And I think it's obviously very shocking. And at the time, this was quite a groundbreaking statistic because no one had really quantified it in that way yet. So then in 2020, we shifted to looking at the impacts of the pandemic and came out with a report called What Happened? How the Humanitarian Response to COVID-19 Failed to Protect Women and Girls. And that report used evidence from safety audits to show that women and girls did face increased risk of GBV during the pandemic, which everyone kind of, you know, seems well established now, and we call it the shadow pandemic. So I wanted to mention that just to say that our reports are definitely iterative in nature. They build on each other, and we want to continuously kind of look at and investigate barriers and enabling factors to prioritizing gender-based violence interventions. And I think what's really exciting about this report and previous reports is that although they are policy reports, we work very closely with our technical colleagues, which very much ensures that the findings are rooted in evidence from program implementation. So with that background, I'll kind of come back to the report this year, Why Not Local? I jokingly like to call this report the love child between Where is the Money and the What Happened report, because we do a stock take of how women and girls are still being impacted by COVID-19, similar to the What Happened report. But we also do a snapshot of funding similar to the Where is the Money report. But a question that we really wanted to explore much more deeply in this report was the question, what are the barriers that women-led organizations are experiencing in the humanitarian system? So this year, women-led organizations were very much a key stakeholder that were included in the key informant interviews alongside other humanitarian actors, including IRC staff and UN personnel across the three countries included in the report.
I think it's really powerful to have that focus on things that we're talking about more in humanitarian spaces, like partnership, like making things local. This is the way that the field is shifting, hopefully on a broad scale. I wonder if we can look a little bit at where you're working, Glory. How is COVID-19 still impacting women and girls in South Sudan? And are there innovative ways that programs have been able to adapt?
Just like any crisis or pandemics, the impacts are definitely different among women, girls, men, as well as boys. And in a context where we have pre-existing inequalities as well as heightened vulnerability of women and girls, COVID-19 significantly increased the vulnerability of women and girls, especially to GBV. For a context like South Sudan, where we have multiple humanitarian crises that we are responding to, the pandemic in a way kind of challenged our response as well as our programming. In terms of the women and girls, their way of life was majorly impacted, which led to communities undergoing through psychosocial distress, at the households as well as at the community level. We saw a spike in terms of GBV incidents, especially during the first year of the pandemic. And at the onset also of the pandemic, due to the mobility challenges, lockdowns, movement cessation, there were more barriers in terms of accessing timely services for the GBV survivors. And I remember back then, still at the onset, access to GBV services was really not prioritized because all the attention was given to responding to the COVID-19. And you find because of that, there was limited availability of service provision for the survivors. Looking at the communities also, closure of schools exposed adolescent girls to risk of teenage pregnancies as well as early marriage, because we consider schools more of a safe haven for the girls. Then loss of livelihood throughout this COVID-19 pandemic to an extent has contributed to shift in gender roles, which meant women taking up additional tasks to ensure the sustainability of their families. And in this process, you find they're being exposed more to gender-based violence. Then in terms of the innovative ways as well as adaptations to ensure continuity of services, we focused more on looking at alternative ways of service provision. This included remote service provision through the mobile phones to ensure survivors can call and receive support, as well as individual psychosocial support for those that were in distress. In addition to that, we focused more into utilizing the local media for GBV as well as COVID-19 messaging through information dissemination sessions, increasing staff at some of the core service provision centers, for example, the one-stop center that were receiving a high number of survivors at that time, to ensure that the caseworkers have sufficient time for their self-care. In addition to that, also we looked at scaling up our adolescent girls' engagement. Given the risk that were being increased by COVID-19, we felt that it was high time to prioritize the engagement of the adolescent girls, and this meant more sessions for the girls at the centers as well as for their caregivers. We also incorporated a new component, that is COVID-19 messaging, at our women and girls safe spaces to ensure that women and girls have all the right and sufficient information on COVID-19, because there was a lot of misinformation at the community level in terms of the COVID-19 pandemic. So those were just some the adaptations.
Just to add to what Gloria was saying, or to kind of give a shout out to all of those amazing innovations and our other colleagues in Yemen and Cameroon, we decided to do something in the report where we have quote unquote silver linings boxes, where just as Gloria was mentioning, we really highlight some of the innovative practices that we're seeing, which I think is just so important to give a nod to the frontline responders who were adapting to such a challenging environment, and also the women's organizations that were doing so. So would really encourage listeners listeners to go check out some of those examples in the report across countries.
I love a silver lining. I think that's a really powerful piece to add to the report too, to have that as a little, you know, window into where there have been opportunities seized in this, despite you all doubling, tripling the workload that you had to make these adaptations to make sure women and girls were still accessing services. I'd like to talk a little bit about the role of women's organizations. And since we have you, Glory, looking specifically at South Sudan, what is the role that these women-led organizations played during this time?
Women-led organizations have really contributed significantly in the GBV programming for South Sudan. Given the need for service provision, they have been on the forefront to ensure that GBV services are availed even in the remotest locations of the country. And then as first responders to any form of emergencies, they have played a pivotal role in ensuring that they take rid of the rapid needs assessment whenever there is an emergency, whether it's a conflict that has led to displacement or during the times of flooding where people are displaced. They are on the forefront to ensure that the rapid needs assessment have been conducted and shared with the respective clusters to ensure that there is timely response, as well as ensuring that the issues impacting the well-being of women and girls during such emergencies have been well highlighted to inform the response. In addition to that, women organizations are well familiar and have in-depth knowledge and understanding of the communities that we are working with, and therefore they provide critical insights on what interventions are feasible as well as sustainable for each and every locations where we implement our interventions. In looking at their interventions, their approaches, they are mainly community-led, and this assures the sustainability, and that we've been able to have very responsive programming. We've been able to ensure a timely response.
I'm sure that partnership piece of working with women-led organizations locally is a big silver lining from this. And I know that's work that was already ongoing, but it seems across countries that that's one trend to definitely take forward. I'm wondering if we could zoom out a little bit and talk about what the report identifies as barriers that women's rights organizations face across the three contexts, Cameroon, South Sudan, and Yemen.
As Glory mentioned, women's organizations play an essential role in humanitarian response. And actually, there's so much global rhetoric about their importance before and also during COVID. And yet, unfortunately, our research shows that across all of the contexts that were included in the report, they don't get nearly as much credit as they should. And also, they face steep barriers when it comes to both representation and resourcing. So this is part of the reason in the title of the report why we said that COVID was a, quote, missed opportunity or a missed opportunity for localization. So I want to give a few, I think, tangible examples of what we mean by representation and resourcing. So regarding representation, the author of the report, Marcy Hirsch, looked at all of the humanitarian response plans for the three contexts, and she found that there was not a single mention of women's organizations in the humanitarian response plans. With my policy and advocacy hat on, I'll point to some of the recommendations that we made based on these findings. You know, based on that, we said that moving forward, we really want to see women's organizations being explicitly involved in creating a gender analysis for humanitarian needs overviews, humanitarian response plans. But we also want to see a mapping of women's organizations in humanitarian response plans, because as Glory said, these organizations are there and they're already responding, and yet, and oftentimes they're excluded, and it really just, it doesn't make sense. So this is, yeah, definitely something we would like to see improve. And, you know, all international organizations have a responsibility to play a role in this. And the IRC is very much kind of part of that. You know, we have commitments around increasing the quality of partnerships that we have, but also the number of partnerships that we have with women's organizations. And that links into some of the commitments that we've made in other policy fora, including the Grand Bargain. And then just briefly on funding, there are significant barriers that we see across contexts. So I want to quote actually one key informant from a women's organization, or this quote is in the report. They said, as local as possible, as international as necessary is said, but no one wants their own funding to be threatened. So, you know, moving forward, we really want to see donors providing more multi-year flexible funding to women's organizations. And we also want this funding to be able to be used to cover overhead expenses, not just project costs. So this, as you were kind of referencing earlier, Christy, is very much part of a larger, very important mission to pursue aid reform. And then also for those who are listening who might be interested, we give some data on country-based pooled funds in the report. We also want to see women's organizations being represented on decision-making bodies for country-based pooled funds as a mechanism to hopefully better fund women's organizations. Yeah, I'll stop there and see if, Gloria, if you want to add anything based on your experience.
Yeah, I think, Liana, you've already outlined some of the major barriers, especially as mentioned by some of the women organizations that took part in the development of the report. But just from my experience, when it comes to the limited funding as well as the time about projects that I find most of the women organizations are being supported to implement, these have not been sufficient to fully invest in their overall growth as well as capacity, not just in terms of the interventions, but also risk carry within the organizations, which include the leadership of the organization. And because of this, when they are fundraising for some of the available opportunities, they often face major requirements, which at times they are not able to meet, not because they cannot do it, but because the capacity is not fully in line with what the donor wants. So because of these, I think it's high time we look into how best they can be supported, not just with funding for implementation, but also in terms of their overall capacity.
I think that's a really interesting point, Glory. And I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit more about that. When you were developing this report, or what Marcy reported from the report, what did you find were trends when you looked at global humanitarian funding to GBV?
Yeah, so in the report, we looked at humanitarian funding to addressing GBV in the three countries from the years 2019, 2020 to 2021. And that was because we really wanted to see what the funding picture was like before the pandemic and then during and kind of as we hopefully move out of the pandemic. And what our data shows was that there was a slight increase in funding to addressing GBV in South Sudan and Yemen from 2019 to 2020, but that this was followed by a decrease again then in 2021. So I think the findings are nuanced, but I think the key thing is that while we would welcome the increase in funding seen in 2020, what's important to note is that according to our key informant interviews, that increase in funding was not felt on the ground due to increased operating costs demanded by program adaptations and also COVID mitigation, as Glory was kind of mentioning at the beginning. So I think this really shows how important it is to look at the qualitative and the quantitative findings side by side. And, you know, one important thing to note when I'm talking about this is this: we don't know how much funding is going to women's organizations. That's something that we would really like to see being tracked in the future. So that funding, you know, is capturing humanitarian funding, but is not tracking funding that might be cascaded or passed on to women's organizations, which would be something that would be really important to deliver on commitments in the future. I will say just really quickly for listeners who are really interested in data and the financial tracking service, there are a few limitations, of course, with our trends analysis of the funding to GBV. So, of course, the obvious one is that we were only able to look at three countries. So we have a relatively small sample size. We're not speaking to the global picture in this report, but it is interesting to have this snapshot across the three countries. There are some other limitations that come with using financial tracking service data. Among those are the fact that funding to GBV falls under the wider protection sector, so it can be really difficult to track and determine precisely what was spent on GBV. Additionally, the FTS is updated throughout the year. So all of that is just to say that what we had was a snapshot of the data at that point in time, and we'd love to see continued improvements with FTS to be able to kind of better track GBV funding into the future. And also very much we're calling on the FTS to track funding that is going to local partners, including women's organizations. In the report, we call this, quote, measuring what you treasure. If we do want to fund women's organizations, then we will have to track that to hold ourselves to account.
Sounds like an opportunity for another report, if measurements allow. I'm really interested in that. I think that's a fascinating piece of this report and the series of reports that's kind of underreported generally. It's not something that's covered. And I think following the money where it goes is a really interesting way to quantify what we're treasuring, as you said. I want to talk about one of the positive findings in the report that's included in a case study you have on the importance of setting GBV interventions as a priority. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, there was a really an interesting finding, which was that in South Sudan, we saw the largest relative increase in funding to GBV in 2020. And I think that is a really interesting case study. If Glory, you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. So though we are not yet where we want to be in terms of the prioritization of GBV in the humanitarian response, for South Sudan, we must say that we have some milestones that have been achieved, especially in terms of our resource allocation. Looking back from where we started, it's not where we are at the moment. And we give credit to the GBV partners led by the GBV subcluster for their continuous advocacy. But one of our main highlights was when the former emergency relief coordinator, that is Mark Rocock, made protection from GBV as one of his strategic steers. And because of this, there was an effect of prioritization, which was trickled down to the humanitarian coordinators across the respective humanitarian context. And this led to a more prominent inclusion of a GBV in the humanitarian response plans during his tenure. And as you know, the humanitarian response plan is a highly influential document that mainly influences donor investment as well as provide insights on the key focus areas of response. And this increased the visibility of GBV, which was very meaningful. And looking back in, for instance, in 2019, the humanitarian coordinator announced that South Sudan Humanitarian Fund would dedicate at least $2 million exclusively for GBV interventions. And this was very helpful because also it contributed in a way of ensuring women organizations and an opportunity to get some funding to contribute to the life-saving GBV interventions across the country. Again, in 2020, there was a COVID-19 addendum to the humanitarian response plan, which included a dedicated section highlighting on the plight of women during the COVID-19, outlining the risk of GBV prior to the pandemic, as well as the appropriate concerns regarding to the risk that came along with COVID-19. And this saw a slight improved funding picture for the year 2020. So 2019 and 2020, we saw some great milestones in terms of inclusion of GBV, as well as highlighting the GBV concerns in the humanitarian response plan.
I love this. Thanks for sharing that, Glory. I think there's a lot in this report that are opportunities for future learning, and also a lot of gems that came out of this, like the one you've just mentioned, Glory. We're looking at key takeaways from this report for everyone who's listening. Let's just get to it. Who do you think needs to read this report? Who's your ideal role or type of person to read this report? And what specific recommendations do you have for them?
Thanks, Christy. Yeah, I think it's a really important question and one that we definitely try to keep in mind while we're writing it. I mean, to be really, really blunt, I suppose we want donors and we want multilateral organizations to read this report because policies at the global level and really at the top really do matter. But I think also, you know, we want humanitarian coordinators, for example, to read this report. I think the example that Glory gave in South Sudan is a perfect illustration of how you need everyone at every stage of the humanitarian system to understand the importance of responding to GBV from the start. But yeah, that example in South Sudan, not to be underestimated, because we see the impact that high-level statements can have on humanitarian response. So we really want to see that high-level prioritization. And, you know, on that point, we haven't seen that high level prioritization on GBV from the new emergency relief coordinator, Martin Griffiths, but we want to because we have this evidence, of course, that those decisions can really impact the reality on the ground. So I don't know if I can say I hope that Martin Griffiths reads this report, but maybe that will happen. And finally, I think just to go back to highlight some of the recommendations that I already talked about in this report, but the one that I would really like to emphasize for listeners and hopefully those those audiences that we hope are reading the report. I'll just go back to the recommendation around representation of women's organizations and funding for women's organizations. So donors, multilateral organizations, and international organizations all very much have a role to play in system reform and in distributing power more equally. As Glory outlined, women's organizations are first responders who understand very intimately the needs of women and girls in their communities. So they should absolutely have a bigger say in the decisions that impact them.
The report highlights a number of challenges. We don't have all the answers, but there are arrows pointing us in a clear direction. And I'm hoping that at some point in the future, this will be something of the past. This will be something that got started now, but it'll be a regular part of the way we work going forward. In addition to keeping a priority on the needs of women and girls and funding to addressing GBV, this report is a call for system reform. Now is the time to act for a more equitable distribution of power with feminist and women-led organizations. The report, which was funded by Irish Aid, is available now at rescue.org and gbvresponders.org. Go check it out now. It's there. I want to thank our guests for joining me today, and a special thanks to all of the colleagues who were involved in making this report, as well as the key informants without which this wouldn't be possible. So looking forward to this report and also to any more in the series that you all have coming up. It sounds like this is just the start.
Thanks so much for having us, Christy.
Thank you.
Safety, voice, respect. Join the WPE movement.